It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
So there I was, sitting on the set with Kevin McCarthy yesterday, the former House Speaker. And we had a feisty conversation. We talked about Ukraine. We talked about his successor, Mike Johnson, and how much his job is in jeopardy. We talked about McCarthy's own ouster, what was really behind it. He still blames Matt Gaetz. We talked about comments by Hillary Clinton, and on and on. But the moment that's gotten the most attention, and by the way, I hope you had a good weekend, and the interview was everywhere. It's picked up by the Huffington Post and Mediaite, and it was just replayed on Morning Joe, was this moment when I said, talking about Donald Trump's trial, that did he have any proof in saying that Joe Biden was behind this when Biden had said in a TV interview that Trump's lack of ethics has nothing to do with me, and I haven't discussed this with anybody in my administration. So first McCarthy said, he spoke privately to people. And I said, look, there's a difference between going public and privately venting to your staff. And so he didn't have any evidence. And I've raised this with Donald Trump as well in our interview. They take it as a matter of fact that Joe Biden has intervened or orchestrated somehow this case brought by an elected district attorney in Manhattan, Alvin Bragg. So then McCarthy made the point, not an unreasonable point, that it's not fair to have this trial during the presidential election, and that Biden should say so, that Biden should use his influence to say that we can't have this trial now. And I immediately jumped on that and said, hold on. You're saying that it's okay for President Biden to intervene with this trial or the other trials as long as he does it on the side of Donald Trump. And McCarthy said, no, I'm just saying Biden should be fair. Biden should say it's wrong to have this trial now. But I don't see the distinction. What he was clearly suggesting is that the President of the United States should intervene with his Department of Justice and somehow get this stopped. And I don't think he should intervene either way. So that made a lot of news. Okay, story number one. Opening statements in the first criminal trial of a former president of the United States. Now, because of my deadline, I can only give you the prosecution opening statement, but tomorrow we'll catch up with the defense opening statement and perhaps the first witness, David Pecker, who was the owner of AMI, parent company of the National Enquirer. Now, before they even got to opening statements, the judge ruled on what Donald Trump could be questioned on if he decides to testify. He says he's going to. I'm sure his lawyers don't want him to. He can be asked about the civil trials, including the civil fraud trials for which he was held liable for, you know, almost $500 million, and also the E. Jean Carroll defamation and sexual assault civil cases. Now, basically, the National Enquirer is sort of at the center of what the prosecutor, assistant DA Matthew Colangelo is saying. Talks about the catch and kill deals. There were three of them. One of them, of course, involved the $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels. And the second one involved Karen McDougal, also got payment through the National Enquirer. In her case, it was $150,000. She alleges a 10-month affair. Stormy Daniels only alleges a one-night encounter. Trump has denied both. And this was to write a column for one of Pecker's other magazines. And then there was the doorman, This was the doorman suggesting that something, a story that turned out to be false about Trump fathering a child out of wedlock. I want to repeat that that was false. Now, it's worth noting that Colangelo talked about several times, mentioned the word conspiracy between Trump, his former lawyer Michael Cohen, and David Pecker. But he's not charged with conspiracy, so a little bit of creative argument there. Defendant, meaning Trump, was paying Cohen back for an illegal payment to Stormy Daniels on the eve of an election, the 2016 election, to be sure. Now, let me look at some of the notes here. And by the way, it's just weird because the networks flash up on the screen the latest thing that the prosecutor said that, as relayed by reporters inside the courtroom, and then, you know, within 2 seconds, you hear the anchors repeat that very thing. It's like watching, Kimmel or Colbert or Fallon. And you can also see the cue cards while they're telling the jokes. Okay, so the argument here is that Donald Trump was lying about these records. That Trump and his pal David Pecker worked together to buy stories, that Trump personally directed the $130,000 to Stormy Daniels. Oh, as I'll interrupt myself to say, the defense is arguing that President Trump did not commit any crimes. And they're calling him President Trump because he was the president. Goes on to say, and again, back with the prosecution opening argument, that Pecker would act as the eyes and ears for the defendant. Cohen was described as Trump's fixer. He used AMI not just to suppress these stories involving Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, who I'm sure we will hear from, but to attack candidate Trump's political opponents. This was hatched at a meeting in August of 2015, almost at the very beginning of the Trump campaign. And this was all decided in advance. It was Cohen, acting on Trump's behalf, according to the prosecution, who asked AMI to buy Kara McDougal's story. Trump, quote, desperately didn't want that out because it came after the Access Hollywood tape, you know, grab him by the private parts. And to have that come out so soon, and by the way, they quoted from the Access Hollywood tape. I've mentioned on previous podcasts that they can't play it under a ruling by Judge Juan Merchan, but they can quote from it, which doesn't have quite the same impact, but nevertheless. Now, the prosecutor read the quotes from the tape. "This is election fraud, pure and simple," says the assistant DA. "Trump had to figure out some other way of reimbursing Michael Cohen." By the way, Trump invited David Pecker and Dylan Howard, who ran the Inquirer day to day, and was involved in lots of major Inquirer stories and controversies, including the Jeff Bezos below the belt picks and others, Tiger Woods. The prosecutor saying they agreed to cook the books, that they were absolutely conducting this conspiracy, though again, Trump not charged with conspiracy. The amount of money that Cohen received was doubled to make it look like he was just getting ordinary income. And it was on the plane that Trump was asked about, before Michael Cohen turned on him and before Michael Cohen himself went to prison, that Trump was asked what happened here. And Trump said, "You'll have to ask my lawyer, Michael Cohen. I don't know anything about it." So the assistant DA says this was the beginning of the cover-up because Trump was not honest with what he said on the plane. Again, they agreed to cook the books. Now, the prosecution then tried to inoculate Cohen because they know his credibility is absolutely going to be at risk, and saying Cohen has made mistakes in the past. But keep an open mind because there's other information to back up what Michael Cohen says. And Michael Cohen, of course, will probably be the star witness, unless you want to consider it David Pecker or even Stormy Daniels. I can't conceive of a situation here where Stormy Daniels doesn't testify. Now, I can give you a little bit of the defense. Trump's attorney. The 34 counts, ladies and gentlemen, are really just pieces of paper. None of this was a crime. I don't know whether he's going to argue that Trump didn't know about the reimbursement. Trump did talk about that when he was at the Harlem bodega. Whether that's his defense, that somebody else handled it, he didn't know, but they've got to explain away what the former president said on the plane. So the prosecution tried to inoculate Cohen. Cohen, of course, is going to testify and say exactly how he saw it, why he was reimbursed. And Todd Blanche, the defense lawyer, did acknowledge that Stormy Daniels signed an NDA in October of 2016 in exchange for that $130,000. So you see the outlines of the both sides case. And once we get to the witnesses, Cohen, Stormy, Karen McDougal, Pecker's going first, and Hope Hicks, and perhaps others, it'll be a lot to keep up with the examination and cross-examination, but we'll do our best. Story number two. What happened over the weekend is that Mike Johnson stepped up at the risk of his own job and got the House, with help from Democrats, I have to add, to pass desperately needed aid for Ukraine, as well as for Israel, as well as for Taiwan, as well as for a fourth measure that, among other things, would include a ban on TikTok unless a Chinese parent company sells it. And this morning, for the first time, because I made this observation on Media Buzz as well, that you would think there would be praise for Mike Johnson because he was supposed to aid to Ukraine when the only thing he had to worry about was representing his Louisiana district. And he's put his own job at risk. Marjorie Taylor Greene, now joined by two other Republicans, if she follows through, makes it what's called on the Hill a privilege motion, meaning it has to be voted on in two legislative days. McCarthy said he didn't think it would come to that. But putting his job on the line in order to do what, in my view at least, is the right thing. Now, I think the reason that the praise is tempered somewhat or muted somewhat is that Mike Johnson created the problem that he is now finally solved. For six long months, he would not bring this up. He wouldn't bring it to the floor, despite what we now know is substantial bipartisan support. And look, I mean, certainly the attack by Iran against Israel, more than 300 drones and missiles, fortunately, almost completely unsuccessful, and prompting Israel to do a sort of a pinprick response. Bibi Netanyahu felt that he had to have some response, and the Israelis hit a military base, among other targets, in Iran, but carefully calibrated so that there were no casualties, so that the nuclear program nearby, nuclear labs, were not affected, Israel making no comment, And then Iran making no comment. Clearly, both sides want to de-escalate. Especially now that Israel has demonstrated that while Iranian drones and missiles couldn't get through Israel's state-of-the-art air defense system, the Israelis were able to penetrate whatever protections that military base has and strike at will. But back to Mike Johnson. He's risked his job because Marjorie Taylor Greene and two other Republicans can move this motion at any time. She didn't commit to doing it. She said she wants members to go back to their district for a week and hear from their constituents. But I do think, ultimately, that Johnson deserves some credit, even if he is putting out the fire that he himself started. So what happened is that he got classified briefings from the likes of the CIA director. He met with Republicans of various factions. He talked about his son, who's supposed to start the U.S. Naval Academy this fall. And he said, this is not a game. This is really serious. Kind of siding with those who've been saying, look, I mean, Ukraine is running out of ammunition. Russia is regaining territory. Without some U.S. military aid, Ukraine is on track to lose the war, rewarding Putin for his completely unprovoked invasion of a sovereign country. And the New York Times says that after he worked out the plan and he really has ticked off the hardline conservatives, Johnson, who's an evangelical Christian, knelt and prayed for guidance. Republican Foreign Affairs Chairman Michael McCaul, also Republican, recalled the speaker telling him, I want to be on the right side of history. Now, it was easy to get the vote because he had chopped it up into separate pieces. Easy to get the vote for Israel, overwhelming support. 101 Republicans voted for aid to Ukraine. That's a bit less than half of the number of Republicans in the House. But it's a substantial number of Republicans. However, this would have failed if the Democrats had not come to the rescue of this package, knowing full well that if Ukraine doesn't get this aid soon, and I mean soon, there'll be further loss of life and further gains by the Kremlin. It's different when you're a speaker. And he called himself a wartime speaker, and he told reporters at the Capitol, history judges us for what we do. I could make a selfish decision and do something that's different, but I'm doing here what I believe to be the right thing. I think providing lethal aid to Ukraine right now is critically important. And that means that he and the 101 Republicans broke with Donald Trump, who, you know, has come up with, well, it should be a loan. And in fact, it is a loan, but a loan doesn't necessarily have to be repaid. Johnson said, I believe the intel. I think Vladimir Putin would continue to march through Europe if he were allowed. I think he might go to the Baltics next. I think he might have a showdown with Poland or one of the NATO allies. McCaul said, well, all of a sudden, he's realizing that the world depends on this. This is not some little political game on the floor. Meanwhile, in terms of Israel, there is reporting that Bibi Netanyahu was going to retaliate directly and forcefully against the Iranians the night of that attack. The first attack ever by Iran, not through its proxies, on the state of Israel. But at the urging of the U.S. and other allies, decided not to. And this shows to me, I think, that right now, Joe Biden has more leverage or is back to having leverage with Netanyahu, whereas that was very much in doubt during this period when he was urging restraint and get more aid to the Palestinians and deal with the problem of starvation and all of that. However, the taboo against direct strikes on each other's territory is now gone. So if there is another round, then who knows what could spark further back and forth. Both Israel and Iran would feel more free to just attack each other directly. U.S. officials also worrying that this may accelerate the confrontation over Iran's nuclear program itself, which has been hidden to a greater degree from UN inspectors.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Story number three is something that I bet a lot of you have done, that I have done at times. It's interesting. It actually made the front page in the New York Times, although it's not sort of breaking news. Starts off with the example of a guy named Josh Mizell and his wife. They wanted to watch a drama called Poker Face, not familiar with it, on the Peacock channel. But they didn't subscribe to Peacock. They already were paying for a half dozen other streaming services. I mean, that's the problem with this situation. You know, you subscribe to Netflix, you subscribe to maybe Max, you subscribe maybe to Apple TV, you subscribe maybe to Hulu, and it gets expensive. I mean, the analog here would be in the days when there were essentially three networks and a handful of local channels, that you would pay money just for ABC. And then you would have to pay money separately just for NBC. And then you would have to pay money just separately for CBS. So what happened is this guy decided to drop Max, drop Apple TV, drop Hulu. But later he resubscribed to Hulu and Apple when there were shows that he wanted to watch. Because you can do that just like that. So you drop in and you drop out. It's very easy to cancel. Americans are getting increasingly impulsive about hitting the cancellation button on their streaming services. More than 29 million, about a quarter of subscribers to these streaming services, have canceled three or more services over the last 2 years. And those numbers are going up. So, you know, it used to be cable. You got one subscription. You got the sports. You got the news. You got the entertainment channels. Maybe you added something premium. But now the Times refers to them as nomadic subscribers. You know, with a press of a button, you can just opt out. So the president of a research firm says, in 3 years, this went from a very niche behavior to an absolute mainstream part of the market. Traditional media companies like Paramount, Warner Brothers Discovery, NBC Universal, Disney are trying to navigate this. Peacock, by the way, which is owned by NBC, lost $2.8 billion last year. So that has caused a lot of them to cut back on investing in shows because if you're not getting the revenue, you have less to spend on paying the creative people who provide this. So these serial churners, is the term of art, accounted for about 40% of all new subscriptions and cancellations. Now, one option would be, and there's some movement in this direction, for example, Disney can bundle Disney Plus, Hulu, ESPN Plus into one package. It is also joined with Fox and Warner Brothers Discovery in announcing a sports streaming service. So in other words, putting together packages so that the consumer can buy one bundle and get a bunch of things. Now, this is interesting. I don't know if you recall this, but Peacock was going to stream, did stream an NFL playoff game that it was heavily promoting. So in order to keep people from not defecting, you sign up for a full year, $30, half the normal price. But if you canceled within a certain amount of time, then you got charged more. So it's interesting, everybody's playing with this. Story number four, I have talked a whole lot, as well as on Media Buzz yesterday, about Uri Berliner, the guy who, you know, he resigned, but as one of my guests said, you know, he was kind of forced to resign after having been suspended without pay, after going public with his view that NPR has gone off the rails. The guy's an award-winning senior business editor. He's worked there 25 years. He's gone off the rails toward sort of la-la liberalism. And Andrew Sullivan weighs in on this, and he does it in a way that I think is worth sharing with you on his Substack. I used to be quite fond of NPR. Every time I tune in, I'd be treated to calm, reassuring voices, occasional folk music, and high-minded liberalism. Yes, it was biased, but in a tolerable, occasionally hilarious way. Yes, we used to refer to All Things Considered as All Things Distorted, but it was a tease, not an indictment. I hadn't heard that one. So when he read about the new CEO, Catherine Marr, being criticized for past tweets, and I've shared some of this with you, and I read some on the air yesterday, for embracing liberal causes, Sullivan says, well, who running the MSM doesn't embrace liberal causes? Wall Street Journal says the tweets indicate liberal leanings. Except that included calling Donald Trump a deranged racist and a photo of her wearing a Biden campaign cap. Nothing to see here, just a liberal CEO getting blasted by a far-right activist after Berliner wrote a public critique of NPR. But of course, says Andrew, the MSM is lying by obfuscating Marr's politics and her tweets to make her views seem far milder than they really are. She's not, in fact, a liberal of any kind. She is a near parody of an illiberal leftist, dedicated to replacing free and open debate with benign censorship, constructing a journalistic regime rooted not in the pursuit of truth, but in the urgent task of dismantling white supremacy. I mean, one of the things that I read on the air was after the riots that followed George Floyd's murder in 2020, she said, well, of course, you know, not defending rioting, not defending looting, but how upset can you be when people are so angry? And she mentioned slavery. And, you know, we're talking about a system that rewarded the seizing of property back in the days of slavery. Silence is complicity, she said in 2020. She went after James Bennett, the fired editorial page editor of the New York Times, for platforming GOP Senator Tom Cotton. She referred to her cis white mobility privilege. She chided Hillary, who's on her side, for saying boy and girl, because that erases language for non-binary people. And this is precisely, says Sullivan, why Marr was selected to be NPR CEO. Her full tweetage is a deep dive into the successor ideology. First and foremost, it means an end to the Enlightenment idea of empirical truth, discoverable by a curious human being regardless of his or her identity. This idea is, in fact, a, quote, white male westernized construct, as Amar once said in an interview. Seeking the truth, this is wild, she gave a TED talk. Seeking the truth and seeking to convince others of the truth might not be the right place to start. In fact, our reverence for the truth might be a distraction. We all have different truths. Yeah, we all have different truths. So there's no such thing as truth, and everybody gets to share their own truth. And this, as Sully points out, was how Claudine Gay was picked to run Harvard.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Story number five. This is a genuine cultural phenomenon. Taylor Swift and her new album in air quotes. Although I read just the other day that more albums, I'm talking about the vinyl kind, were sold last year than CDs. So albums have made a comeback. Anyway, as you know, it's called the Tortured Poets Department. And the Washington Post has something about the buildup here. First of all, for example, Taylor Swift opened an account on Threads. And within, I don't know, a day, maybe 2 days, she had 1 million followers. I mean, this is the most famous female singer and songwriter on the planet. So it turns out that even though she made this album public just a couple days ago, there were also, it actually is a double album, there were also 17 other tracks that were not supposed to be released yet. 17. And there were premature reviews, and look, I'm not a Swiftie, I don't think I'm in the target demographic, but I admire the fact that this woman works as hard as she does, and makes as much music as she does and has made $1 billion touring. So she made the surprise announcement that it was a double album. And some of her fans were like, don't touch it. Don't go to these other tracks. It's not fair. It's not fair to Taylor Swift. Now, there was a time when if online music leaked prematurely, and this goes, I mean, the roots of this is in Napster, you know, which would put up music illicitly and eventually got run out of business. So what would happen is lots of people would download the leaked songs and then not buy them. But now we're in the age of streaming. And now people are going to stream, and it's almost like free publicity. And this has happened repeatedly to Taylor Swift. She said in an interview about 14 years ago with Rolling Stone that she cried after learning that a track from her third studio album was leaked 12 days early, and they rushed the song to iTunes. And the same thing happened with her fifth album, 1989. That was a decade ago. And albums 6 and 7. Now, she has important allies in her war against leaks. By the way, she's back on TikTok after protesting by getting off. After the 1989 leak, Taylor Swift said, "It was the first time I've had an album leak without it trending on Twitter because my fans protected it. Anytime they'd seen an illegal post, they'd comment, 'Why are you doing this? Why don't you respect the value of art? Don't do this.'" Now, having set that up, I have to say that the reviews were not great for Tortured Poets. Not just the professional viewers, but, you know, I couldn't, it was inescapable. I mean, everybody was weighing in. Some people loved it. But a lot of people were saying, look, this was all about a period of her life when you would think she's the most successful person, you know, entertainer on the planet. When she should have been really happy. But she's still mad at some of the boyfriends. She gets even with them. But the main complaint I heard was a lot of the songs sound similar. They love Taylor Swift, but this music isn't interesting. And a lot of it was kind of downbeat, not without up-tempo songs that you would expect from Taylor Swift, where you can, you know, turn up the car radio and race down whatever highway you're racing down. So for all of her fame and obvious talent, I would say a lot of her fans are disappointed in the official part of the album, not leaving aside the ones that leak, which I don't have a take on. But, so like here's the New York Times review, and it's similar to many others. Taylor Swift's trademark has been abundance. At 34, she's more popular and prolific forever, sating her ravenous fan base and expanding her cultural domination. What Swift reveals on her sprawling and often self-indulgent 11th LP, The Tortured Poets Department, is that this stretch of productivity and commercial success was also a tumultuous time for her emotionally. I can read your mind. She's having the time of her life. Swift sings on, I can do it better. I can do it with a broken heart. And yet, that's what she continues to provide. Gone are the character studies, says this Times review, and fictionalized narratives of Swift's 2020 Foc Pop albums Folklore and Evermore. The Feverish Tortured Poets is a full-throated return to her specialty, autobiographical and sometimes spiteful tales of heartbreak, full of detailed referential lyrics that her fans will delight in decoding. Swift doesn't name names, but she drops plenty of bold-faced clues about exiting a long-term cross-cultural relationship that has grown cold, briefly breaking up or taking up with a tattooed bad boy. But daddy, I love him. And starting fresh with someone who makes her sing in football metaphors. Who could that be? There is a reference to the Chiefs. I mean, just clearly one point where she's talking about Travis Kelce, her current boyfriend. So the songs are potent reminders, at least a couple of them, how viscerally Swift can summon the flushed delirium of a doomed romance. One duet with Post Malone is chilly and controlled until lines like, I love you, it's rooting my life, inspire the song to thaw and glow. Even better is the chatty, radiant title track. Swift self-deprecatingly compares herself and her lover to more daring poets before concluding, this ain't the Chelsea Hotel, we're modern idiots. Many Swift songs get lost in dense thickets of their own vocabulary. But here, the goofy particularity of the lyrics, chocolate bars, first name nods to friends, is strangely humanizing. But for all its sprawl, Tortured Poets is a curiously insular album. There's a sonic uniformity to much of the album. Gauzy backdrops, gently thumping synths, drum machine rhythms that lock her into a clipped, chirping staccato, suggesting that her partnership with producer Jack Antonoff has become too comfortable and risks growing stale. Now, I'm sure some of you disagree with that. I'm sure some of you agree with that. Eventually, we'll get the official release of the 17 tracks that make up the double album. But it is just, I mean, so many people are talking about it that I had to devote a segment to it. So thanks for listening. And I'll be back here tomorrow with more BuzzMeter.
Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts and via Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.